This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just thought I'd better very briefly just define some of my terms. I define adult and continuing education. It's one of those slippery phrases, isn't it? As any post-compulsory higher education undertaken for personal, career, or community development, and this can range from part-time degrees to short courses, sub-degree awards, and can typically, especially these days, be anything ranging from CPD, retraining and reskilling, part-time degrees, and short courses in academic disciplines. Now, I was pleased to see that we had the picture of George Birkbeck earlier, because my business, Adult Continuing Education, closely related to that, has a very long history. Some of you will know from the pioneers of extending universities in the 1860s, and famously James Stewart of Cambridge, who began it as a local and private enterprise. And then it took 50 years to develop into a nationally organised and funded system based on regions, each region having a university or a university college as the institution with responsibility and therefore funding to provide for its urban and rural communities. And eventually there were 26 of these. And this system lasted for a remarkably long time. Its funding lasted more or less unaltered for 65 years. How about that for the lifespan of a funding stream? So what about sustaining? It may have had that funding for a long time, and that ended, by the way, in 1989. But sustainability is a perennial difficulty if you are, by definition, marginal. You're vulnerable in tough times. You're vulnerable in good times as well, actually. And so the business has lived with threats to its sustainability throughout its life. Sometimes it's the victim of the law of unintended consequences, and I think we all have stories like that as well. The organisation that the chair mentioned, Universities Association for Lifelong Learning, just to remind you, in case you need reminding, it was founded in 1947 as the University's Council for Adult Education, but actually traces its origins to the Conference of University Extramural Directors in 1923. So we can claim long life. And incidentally, outside, you'll find some leaflets about what we do, including our 2011 conference, which is also on the theme of part-time. Now, on the question of part-time, I've talked to this conference several times, and hitherto, it was on the subject of ELQ. What I said last year was that the ELQ business is very damaging, and although it's now established, it has to be kept in view. And also, I think I said to this conference, it reminds you what severely flawed thinking about part-time higher education can produce. And another thought was, should we be advocating the end of the part-time full-time higher education distinction? Should we be mode blind? Now, this year, I swore to myself I wouldn't mention the ELQ, but it has cast a long shadow. It's cast a long shadow today. Everybody's mentioned it one way or another, because its effects are critical to the questions of sustainability. So what about the sustainability of adult continuing education now? Has it been severely damaged by ELQ? Yes. Lifelong learning provision by universities has been severely cut or changed. University lifelong learning centres were in many cases already feeling the effects of various threats to their work, institutional restructuring, pressures to develop vocational CPD at the expense of public programmes, withdrawal from regional provision, and loss of academic staff and the impact of the RAE. And for some departments, the consequences of the ELQ regulation was the last straw that led them to closure. For others, it meant a rapid realignment of programmes towards vocational training or recruitment of young students, and this saved them from extinction. But you might ask, at what price? I'll give you an example. Archaeology, one of the really popular subjects for adult continuing education students, and it's a subject in which students can make genuine contributions to knowledge. Well, the Council for British Archaeology did some research, which it published recently, on the decline of adult continuing education programmes in universities, and it found various factors responsible for that. But ELQ was the worst, and I just quote, "The cuts in ELQ funding for universities tops the list of concerns for the future of continuing education. Such is its current detrimental effect. The effects of the government-imposed ELQ cuts have been extremely severe." And we must remember, before I sound too parochial, that the impact of these regulations was institution-wide, as you know, not just on our bit. In fact, 50% of the detrimental effects of the ELQ rules were on other parts of the university. I'll give you an example. A level one, HE level one certificate in business development, been running successfully for several years, but it recruited viable numbers, but one of the students had an MBA, and several of the other students, quite a few of them, had technical qualifications of varying sorts, all of them, though, at level four. The result was too many unfundable students, the course closes. And this, I think, has been a feature, that courses which are actually doing good work for people without previous higher education experience are being closed simply for a lack of viability of recruitment. And I'll give you a quote from the director of a Russell Group continuing education department. He says to me, "It's worth pointing out, of course, that this decision, and the decision was to close their level one, HE level one public programmes, forced on us by the ELQ policy, has actually resulted in opportunities being denied to those who don't have any HE experience, approximately 40%. And courses like that, of course, are feeders to more advanced courses. And if you take out a rung in a progression ladder, you will make that progression that much harder. So what's the picture for adult continuing education now? All universities have realigned their provision, ranging from getting rid of it to changing it radically. Some have closed. Reading, Lancaster, one or two others have actually closed down. Others have changed their provision to income-generating CPD and training. This really as the price the university insists on for continuing to exist. And some have taken some bold steps, some radical steps, of freeing themselves from the constraints of funding regulations, though, of course, at the expense of the funding itself. And the presentation after mine will take you through an enterprising example of that. So the business is in a perilous condition, exacerbated by the major reduction in local authority adult education and in the provision by the WEA, which leaves large areas of the country devoid of opportunity for adults wanting courses for personal academic development, change career, or to keep active and healthy in retirement. Though continuing education survives and indeed thrives in certain places, I was most interested to see Claire's map and her identification of at least two of her hotspots as places where it was the adult continuing education programmes in those places which boosted part-time numbers. Well, we've got a new government, we've got a spending review, and we have, at the least as a serious straw in the wind, we have the Brown Review. So what can we glean for that for adult continuing education? Well, higher fees, no doubt about that. One assumes at least double, whatever cap. And this will hit part-time hard. On the other hand, those studying for 40 credits or more will get loans, have access to loans. They will have parity with full-time, and this is very good in principle. It's understandable, incidentally, I think, that the financial support should operate above a threshold, and 33% is at least better than the 50% previously, though we have had arguments today that actually it would be quite nice if it was reduced to 30 credits instead of 40. So there is a big advance in the serious treatment of part-time. And at the end of my presentation to this conference last year, I asked, should we be advocating the end of the part-time, full-time distinction? And Brown offers a step in this direction, parity of access to financial support with full-time students. This incidentally did not apply in 2006 when top-up fees were introduced. And part-time fees, always unregulated, were at the discretion of providers. And incidentally, when the Higher Education Act of 2005, the first version of the HE Bill 2004 did not mention part-time. They simply forgot to put it in. And it was people like myself and others had to nag the draftsman into putting part-time into this at all. It's a measure of the seriousness with which part-time was taken then, as opposed to perhaps we hope now. I thought after 2006 universities would simply charge pro rata fees, full-time fees to their part-timers. I thought their finance directors would insist on that. And they can always via numbers from part-time to full-time. But in fact, that tended not to happen. And the reasons it didn't happen were twofold. One was so as not to destroy a large part-time market. And secondly, it was a sense of fairness and accessibility to non-traditional students, applicants. But now if part-time have access to the same loans and support, you could argue there is no incentive to continue that relatively generous attitude. If Brown is implemented, part-time will probably cost the same as full-time pro rata. And just a sentence from the Higher Education Policy Institute response to Brown: part-time students with an FTE of one-third or more are to be entitled to the same loans as full-timers to cover the cost of their fees, with the strong implication, therefore, that the fees that the part-timers pay will need to be the same pro rata as full-timers. So, if part-time students get the same financial support, is this fair? And I think, as one or two people have said already, yes, but. And from my point of view, I think the buts are, first of all, that the older the student, the less career advantage flows from graduate status, and thus the less, perhaps, is the acceptability of substantial debt beyond existing financial commitments of mortgage and family, say. And it's possible, and again this was mentioned earlier, that part-time students, if they are more likely to be non-traditional, they are perhaps more likely to be debt-averse. And secondly, if fees do rise pro rata, then what survives of open access public higher education courses of 10 to 30 credits has a bleak future indeed, especially as most students on these courses are studying humanities and social sciences. There is one, I think, remarkable hint in Brown, we've had it mentioned already, that the ELQ rule may be revisited. Our proposals create the potential for government to review the restrictions on access to funding to students who are studying for a second degree. The ability to retrain will be increasingly important. And given the utter intransigence of ministers when this was first introduced, and the far worse financial climate now, this comes to me as a surprise. So I think we should keep up pressure on this glimpse, however distant, of a reappraisal. But the danger, though, is that given the cuts to the teaching funding, that even if ELQ were to be reversed, it's quite possible there is no funding to restore. So to end, what hopes then for adult continuing education? Brown offers at last a step towards parity for part-time students. It's understandable there should be a threshold for eligibility, and 33% is an improvement on what went before. But the overall large fee increases will impact heavily on part-time students, and part-time fees will probably not be allowed to be less than pro rata. Students on courses of 10 to 30 credits will have no financial assistance, yet they are often taking tentative first steps into further progression. So it's a mixed message, and for me too, it gets two cheers. There are some currently fashionable areas, though, where universities and learners can perhaps benefit from the practice and research of adult continuing education. There are some buzz phrases that we ought to make sure we pick up on and link into. The whole thing about regional development, the whole thing about community, citizenship, public engagement, and, as has been said today, the big society. And on the demand side, The demand is there. And interestingly, when ACE departments have been formally closed, sometimes there are, and it's a bit like a bonfire which refuses to be extinguished, flickers of new life in, on the one hand, demand, and on the other, a few committed university staff determined to offer something. So this has strong echoes of where I started in the 1860s and pioneers like James Stewart. And I just hope it doesn't take another 50 years to construct a fair and proper funded system. Thank you.